Okay, well, we'll get started here a little late this morning, providentially. You can once again see that God is in control of the weather, no matter what the weather people say. But we're in the middle of our review of the intertestamental period, and we had started last week by reviewing what we did last year, and we're almost through the review of last year. And if you have your handout, the handout says review on at the top, and it's got a little table on the back. This is the one we used last week. So if you have that, we're down to Roman numeral 4. So last week we reviewed the Old Testament background to the period, and then we reviewed some of the sources. You know, how do we know about this period? And that's pretty much where we got through last week, and we'll be picking it up there at the historical summary. And we did have a question at the end of last period about the Apocrypha, and I just wanted to clarify one thing that I said. I said that the Apocrypha had secondary authority in the Roman Church, and that's not exactly true. It was made part of the canon of Scripture at the Council of Trent, as Pastor said last week. The word that's used of the Apocrypha for the Roman Catholic Church is deuterocanonical. So when I said secondary authority, that was not correct. Deuterocanonical means second canon. So it's part of the canon, but it's sort of a secondary part of the canon. But the Council of Trent, they decreed that it does have equal authority with the Old and the New Testament. And so we'll get to the Apocrypha later, but I just wanted to make that clarification. When I said secondary authority, the technical term that's used is deuterocanonical. So we're up to the historical summary, and what we're doing, if you look at your outline, which is under Introduction 1D, you'll see the Old Testament background, the sources, and we're in number 3, the historical summary prior to the Maccabean period. And maybe it might be helpful to mention that this historical summary under number 3 there is divided into 3 major parts: the Persian period, the Alexander the Great period, and then the period after Alexander the Great, where the empire was divided up. And last year we got through the Persian period, and so this morning we'll just do a quick recap of the Persian period, and then we'll move into the new material, which is picking up at the end of the Persian period. So that'll be under, now jumping down to Roman numeral 4 in the historical summary. There's not much information here on the outline. I've given some of the scriptural references, and then basically just a list of the Persian rulers after that. So we covered this in some detail last year, but I'll just give you a quick rundown. And you can kind of refer to the table also. The table has the Persian rulers listed on the left-hand side. And then next to that, you can see the years, as well as some of the biblical things that were going on during that time. So we previously covered the decree of Cyrus, where the exiles returned from captivity in Ezra and 2 Chronicles. And then in Daniel chapter 8, we have the Persian king depicted as the ram. You may remember that prophecy. And then later in Daniel chapter 11, we read about 3 kings after Cyrus, and then a powerful king who would fight against the Greeks, which was Xerxes. We'll get to that in a second. One thing to note, and you can see by your table here, you can see how it corresponds to the list of rulers right up above the table. But probably more than half of the Persian period is actually covered in the Bible. You can see from the scriptural references there down through Nehemiah chapter 13 that all the way through the reign of Artaxerxes I is covered in the Old Testament. And it's only the rulers after that that we have to go to other sources to find out about. So that's an important thing to keep in mind. So then just a quick rundown of the rulers of Persia. Of course, we're familiar with Cyrus, who was the first ruler, and he was the one who really established the Median-Persian Empire. He captured Babylon around 539 BC, and we learn that from Daniel chapter 5. And if anyone is interested in some of the identity questions there, we covered that back last year. You can go listen to the tape, the identity of Belshazzar. The Bible refers, of course, to Belshazzar, but the historical records refer to Nabonides as the ruler of Babylon, and I explained all of that in the previous course, so you can go back and listen to that if you're interested in the identity of Belshazzar, Nabonides, or Darius the Mede that are referred to in Daniel. Cyrus's policy towards the conquered peoples was humane and wise. His philosophy was that if he's humane and liberal in the way he treated the captives, that that would build for a strong kingdom and a strong empire. The Persian Empire was really vast and encompassed a lot of different cultural, ethnic, religious traditions and groups, and it was very difficult to meld that all into a unified empire. But this was his policy, and it seems to have been fairly successful. And really, it was the largest empire in the Middle East. So three or four of these rulers will be very familiar to you from the Bible. The next ruler, actually, that is not mentioned in Scripture is Cambyses. You can see the dates from where he ruled there in your outline. He was the son of Cyrus. He completed the conquest of northern Egypt, which had been begun by Cyrus. He captured Memphis and extended the empire all the way to Ethiopia. And you might recall, it was under his time that the so-called famous Lost Expedition happened. And you might remember us talking about that. But it was the expedition of 50,000 soldiers that were pushing westward from Egypt and were lost, never heard from again. I think a lot of historians believe that they were lost in a sandstorm. Even now, there's people still looking for the Lost Expedition. There's articles out there, some folks who supposedly found it a number of years ago, but most people believe that was a hoax. So this is a puzzle for historians of what actually happened to the Lost Expedition. But that was under this period of time. And then we have Darius the Great, who extended the Persian Empire all the way to India in the east. He also pushed westward towards Greece, and he really extended the Persian Empire to the way it is at its maximum extent. He ruled all of Asia Minor except for Greece itself. Now, Darius was the one that was on the throne during the ministries of Haggai and Zechariah when the temple was being rebuilt. And so his name will be familiar to you from Scripture. One other interesting fact about this time period for Darius, and we again spoke about this last year, but he was the one who created the Behistun inscription, which is an important linguistic tool written in the three languages, Old Persian, Babylonian, and Elamite, similar to the Rosetta Stone, if you're familiar with that. This was another very important inscription that helped us translate the languages. And then following him, we have another familiar character, Xerxes. This is the one in Hebrew. It's Ahasuerus in the Old Testament. And he was the ruler during the events in the book of Esther. And so you can see that from your outline there. Esther happened right in the time of his rule. Xerxes, you remember from what I said there back in Daniel. I don't know if I covered that in detail, but Daniel chapter 11, the three kings after Cyrus. I believe we're going to be reading this in a few moments when we get to Alexander. But Daniel predicted a powerful king who would fight against the Greeks. That was this Xerxes. So he carried on a huge expedition against Greece, really tried to conquer it. And he almost succeeded, but he was pushed back by the Greeks. You remember at this time, Greece was really, it wasn't Greece like we know it today. It was a bunch of city-states that, and you remember from reading Homer's works, that it was just a constant warring between the Greek city-states. And so there wasn't really a unified Greece at this time. But they banded together and were able to repel Xerxes and push him back. And this is important because it was later a strong motivation for Alexander the Great to pushed back into the Persian Empire, because the Greeks remembered this event when Xerxes tried to conquer them. And then after that, we have Artaxerxes. He's still on the table here. This was the man who was on the throne during the ministries of Ezra and Nehemiah. And so you remember that Nehemiah was the cupbearer to the king, and that was Artaxerxes. This was really the beginning of the end of the Persian Empire under his rule. The rising pressure from the Greeks was now starting to push back eastward, and the Persian Empire was beginning to weaken at this point in time. Yes, John. So the question is, did the religious freedom as an example that began under Cyrus, did it continue down through the rest of these rulers? And yeah, it pretty much did. We'll cover it here in the summary, but the Persian rule was very generous to, for instance, the Jews, which is one of our topics of interest here. And as a result of that, the Jews were fairly loyal to the Persian rulers as well. Okay, so the beginning of the decline happened really under Artaxerxes, and then we have a number of other rulers here that I've listed. I'm not going to cover them in any detail. You can see the recurring names over and over again with the family names. The one I will say a couple words about is Darius III. He's the last ruler there under K. You can see the dates when he ruled. This is the man who was defeated by Alexander, and we'll cover him in a few minutes. But this really was the end of the great Persian dynasty. And so, in summary, over the Persian dynasty, the Persian dynasty was a unified, powerful, and widespread, and very long-lived power. The Persian dynasty was in control for about 220 years. If you think about that in perspective, we think about how powerful Babylon was in Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom. That lasted about 60 years, and the Persian rule lasted 220 years. So it really was a remarkable empire, and it really rivals the later Roman Empire, which, of course, was even larger and longer, 450 years about. But the Persian dynasty was really the most powerful empire in the ancient Middle East. We just mentioned that Persian rule was generally friendly to the Jews. We see that in a number of ways. Even in the Bible, it provided for their return from exile under God's providence, supported the rebuilding of the temple in Jerusalem in Nehemiah's day and then earlier when they returned, and then also placing Jews in important positions in the kingdom. Think about the events in Esther when Mordecai, who was a Jew, was made the ruler of the kingdom. You remember that story. There's also examples of garrisons of Jews that were stationed under the authority of the Persian military stationed in Egypt. So there were Jews that were serving in the Persian army at this time, which represents, you know, some of the good relation that they had with the Persians. And so generally it was a very good arrangement for the Jews, and they were generally loyal to the Persian rulers throughout the various political conflicts that happened during this period. Persia left its mark in Palestine. We see that in Jewish architecture as well as the Aramaic language. You know, we're familiar with Aramaic because that was probably actually likely the language that Jesus spoke. It was a very common language in that time. The Aramaic language is a Persian dialect of Assyrian. So that's one way that Persia left its mark in Palestine. And so what was happening with the Jews during this period of time? Well, we know from Scripture all the way down through Artaxerxes what was happening, and we covered that last week in our Old Testament background, how there was a continuing cycle of renewal under prophets and leaders and then subsequent decline as people turned away from the Lord. And so we know about that part. We know that there was a faithful remnant that maintained the true religion in spite of the continued apostasy that we read in. That's represented by people, by biblical figures like Daniel, Mordecai, Esther, Haggai, Zechariah, Ezra, and Nehemiah, and people that joined with them. We know that there was a faithful remnant that was trying to maintain the true religion. The government at this point in time was appointed by the Persian kings. So we'd have governors and rulers who were under the authority of the Persian ruler. And a good example of that is Nehemiah. He was the governor of Judea at that time, appointed by the king. And that was a very common arrangement for people to be governors of all of the different locations under the Persian Empire, again, because it was so vast. They needed to do things like that, have a good interconnected governorship. So it was governed by the Persian kings, but the priesthood continued in Jerusalem. So the Aaronic priesthood, which at this point in time was from the line of Zadok, from the Old Testament, you remember. It was corrupted, definitely, and we'll cover that in some detail later, but it was still from the line of Zadok. We'll see later a major change from that in a later period. But at this point, it was still from the line of Zadok. The Aaronic priesthood continued. And because there was no Jewish king, there was just a governor under the authority of the Persian king, functionally what happened is the high priest had a lot of authority politically over his people, over the people in Palestine. So the high priest was really the one that was viewed from the Jewish standpoint as the leader of the people. He had a significant amount of authority in all of the Jewish affairs. He was subject, of course, to the governor, but the Jews really looked to him as a lead figure because there was no Israelite king in those days. That's kind of the wrap-up of the Persian period. Are there any questions or comments before we move into new material now? This has all been review up to this point from last year. Everything clear? Set the stage for where we are? Okay. I have two new handouts. One of them is the handout, and the other one is a double-sided map page, which is of dubious quality, but hopefully you can see it. Just another word, please keep your handouts because we'll be using them week to week. I won't have a new handout necessarily every week, okay? Okay, so I mentioned that this section of the outline is the historical summary up to the Maccabean period, and it's divided into three subsections. The Persian Empire was the first section, which we've now covered, and we're moving into the second major division here, which is the Alexandrian period. This is a relatively short period, 332 BC to 323 BC. So you can see it's only about 9-10 year period here that we're going to cover. We'll cover this in some detail, but it's just keep in mind that it's relatively short relative to the Persian period that we just covered. We'll look at some of the key sources here. There's biblical sources are Daniel, the book of Daniel, and I'll read a couple of those passages here in a second. First Maccabees is a part of the Apocrypha. That's a very important historical book. And then I've got some other secondary sources here that I won't mention too much about. You might see some footnotes at the bottom of the outline by some of the secondary sources that I'll be using. Again, I have the detailed bibliography if anyone is interested in seeing that. So for background to this, I'm going to read a couple of the source accounts. So I'm going to read starting in Daniel, first of all, chapter 8, and I'm going to read out of the ESV. So I'm going to turn to Daniel chapter 8. This will give you a sort of a summary and an overview of what we're going to talk about. So Daniel chapter 8, starting at verse 1. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after that which appeared to me at the first. And I saw in the vision, and when I saw, I was in Susa, the capital, which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in the vision, and I was at the Ulai Canal. I raised my eyes and saw, and behold, a ram standing on the bank of the canal. It had two horns. And both horns were high, but one was higher than the other. And the higher one came up last. I saw the ram charging westward and northward and southward. No beast could stand before him, and there was no one who could rescue from his power. He did as he pleased and became great. And so an editorial comment, that's the Persian Empire he's talking about there. Verse 5, as I was considering, behold, a male goat came from the west across the face of the whole earth without touching the ground. And the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. He came to the ram with the two horns, which I had seen standing on the bank of the canal, and he ran at him in his powerful wrath. I saw him come close to the ram, and he was enraged against him and struck the ram and broke his two horns. And the ram had no power to stand before him. But he cast him down to the ground and trampled on him. And there was no one who could rescue the ram from his power. Then the goat became exceedingly great. But when he was strong, the great horn was broken. And instead of it, there came up four conspicuous horns towards the four winds of heaven. So that sounds pretty weird, right? It's another one of Daniel's visions. One of the things I love about Daniel is that he was just as puzzled by some of his visions as we are. The great thing about Daniel also is oftentimes he was given the interpretation of his vision, which is given to us in the scripture here. So this one we don't have to puzzle too much about because he gives us the answer, skipping down to, well, starting in verse 15. I won't read it all, but you can see that Daniel sought to understand it, and a man's voice came to him. And I'll skip down to verse 18. And when he had spoken to me, I fell into a deep sleep with my face to the ground. But he touched me and made me stand up. He said, "Behold, I will make known to you what shall be at the latter end of the indignation, for it refers to the appointed time of the end. As for the ram that you saw with the two horns, these are the kings of Media and Persia, and the goat is the king of Greece, and the great horn between his eyes is the first king. As for the horn that was broken, in place of which four others arose, four kingdoms shall arise from his nation, but not with his power." And so we have there the interpretation of both the ram and the goat. The two horns represented the Media-Persian Empire, and then the goat that came from the west without touching the ground. What do you think that refers to? Speed, right. And that's exactly what we're going to see. And then the great horn that was broken off refers to the first king. And then if there's another reference to this over in chapter 11 of Daniel. In verse 2, it says, "And now I will show you the truth. Behold, three more kings shall arise in Persia." That's three kings after Cyrus. "And a fourth shall be far richer than all of them. And when he has become strong through his riches, he shall stir up all against the kingdom of Greece." And remember, we just talked about one of the Persian kings that went after the kingdom of Greece and invaded Greece. That was Xerxes. And so that's what we're talking about there. The fourth that's richer and stirs up all against the kingdoms of Greece. In verse 3, "Then a mighty king shall arise who shall rule with great dominion and do as he wills. And as soon as he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not to his posterity, nor according to the authority with which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up and go to others besides these." So we'll look at that in detail now. Again, this is one of those instances where the prophecy is so accurate that most liberal scholars believe that it was written after the events occurred. Okay, I also wanted to just read a couple of verses from 1 Maccabees. So I'll give you a flavor of what Maccabees is like, but it just refers to this period as well in Alexander. This is what it says. "Alexander of Macedon, the son of Philip, marched from the land of Kittim, defeated Darius, king of Persia and Media, and seized his throne, being already king of Greece. During the course of many campaigns in which he captured strongholds and put kings to death, he traversed the earth to its remotest bounds and plundered countless nations. When at last the world lay quiet under his sway, his pride knew no limits. He built up an extremely powerful army and ruled over countries, nations, and princedoms, all of which rendered him tribute." That's the summary that's given at the very beginning of the book of Maccabees on Alexander. Yes, John? No, this is a historic... First Maccabees is a historical book that was written after the Maccabean Revolt, which was quite a few steps down from where we are right now. Yes, Pastor just reiterated, I think, exactly what I said about the Apocrypha. So, good. So, with that background, let's turn to this period. And really, we're talking about Alexander the Great. And probably a lot of you know a lot about Alexander the Great from school and from studying this period. He was the son of King Philip II of Macedon. What's Macedon when we say that? When I say Macedon, does anybody know what that is? There's got to be some history. Geographical. That's right. Yeah, it's really part of northern Greece and even further north of Greece. So we say that Alexander the Great was Greek. That's not technically true at that point in time. There was a division between the Macedonians in the north and the Greeks, the true Greeks in the south of Greece, in the region of Achaia, if you remember from the Bible. But King Philip had built a very strong Macedonian kingdom. But he was assassinated in 336 BC, and his son, Alexander, inherited the kingdom at the ripe age of 20. So keep that in mind also when you're thinking about Alexander the Great. He started when he was 20. He had a phenomenal education. He studied under Aristotle. His father sent him to study under Aristotle, and so he was very well acquainted with Greek philosophy and culture. He strongly believed in the superiority of the Greek culture, which led to one of his major goals, which was to spread the Greek culture worldwide. So he was definitely bent on military conquest, but he had another motive of spreading the Greek culture across the world because he believed so strongly that it was a superior culture. The extent of his conquest is shown on the map that's really hard to read. It's figure M2. Just to orient you, if you find Italy on the left there, just to the right of Italy, you can locate Greece. And you can see that he spread from there all the way. If you move over to the Mediterranean there, you can see into Assyria, down into Egypt, and then way, way far eastward, all the way to the borders of India. That's the extent of his empire. So again, very, very extensive, pretty much the same extent as the Persian Empire earlier, including Greece, of course. So he set out on a military campaign. Remember that I mentioned that one of his motivations was to punish the Persians for them invading Greece earlier under Xerxes. So he set out on a military campaign. This was in 334 BC. And he followed the reverse path of Xerxes. So Xerxes had come from the east all the way to the borders of Greece. And Alexander basically just went back the other way, following the same path. At this point in time, the Persian Empire was weakened, just as many empires do, by corruption and infighting and mismanagement. And Alexander brought, really what he was building was a superior force, a superior army, and new military techniques that had not been used in the ancient world. If you know anything about Alexander's army, it was renowned for its cavalry, the Macedonian cavalry, and they developed a number of military formations, as I mentioned, that were able to break the traditional lines where people would fight. One of the most famous of these is called the phalanx, and you may have heard that term. There's actually a modern ship-based weapon now called the phalanx system that I happen to be familiar with. But phalanx was a military formation that was perfected during the Macedonian period. And it was a way of wedging and breaking into an enemy's line and basically flanking them. So Alexander was a brilliant military strategist. He was, as you might expect, ruthless to those who opposed him, but he was a driven leader and a very good motivator for his troops with supreme confidence. And, you know, as most of these guys are, he was ruthless to his enemies, but he was also quite generous to his friends. It's very interesting, if you want to read about Alexander, read Plutarch's Lives. He covers Alexander in there. It's very interesting just to read. You can get a lot of insight into Alexander's character by reading that, the way he treated his friends and his enemies. But he pushed through Asia Minor into what is now southern Russia. It's hard to see on that map, but he challenged the Persian army. He brought a large Greek army of 35,000 troops, and he immediately began defeating the Persian army. near the ancient city of Troy in Asia Minor. He had a major victory, and he swiftly moved through Asia Minor eastward, liberating the cities. He said he was liberating the cities. You can see from that. It's very interesting. He destroyed the cities that resisted him, but a lot of towns opened their gates to him because a lot of people welcomed him, one, because they were afraid, probably. But there was this sense that people were really embracing Greek culture at the time, and we'll see this when we get to Palestine. But it's interesting that a lot of towns just opened their gates. So he was liberating them to live the way they ought to be living under Greek culture and rule. But he did destroy those that resisted him. So he finally came up against the Persian ruler Darius III at the Battle of Issus in Syria. That's right to the north of Palestine there on your map, kind of right at the corner of where the Mediterranean comes up there north of Cyprus. If you see that right, there was a decisive battle there at what's called the Sicilian Gate, which was a narrow mountain pass. And Alexander met and defeated the Persian army at that point, led by Darius III, and dealt them pretty much a catastrophic defeat. Darius was allowed to escape, but his entire family was taken hostage. And Alexander, at this point, rather than chase Darius back into Persia, he realized it was probably more important for him to cover his flank because he had moved very rapidly up to that point. And what he did, and we're going to stop here, but what we'll start pick up with next week is he basically stopped at that point to cover his flank, and he moved down along the coast down into Palestine and down into Egypt before he moved all the way further east.